You are listening to Radio Albion.
Hello, this is Matthew Raphael Johnson, and this is yet another broadcast of The Orthodox Nationalist. This is being recorded late in the evening of January 18th, 2025. But like most of what I do here, these are historical topics, philosophical topics that aren't really date sensitive. Now, I want to talk about something that I first mentioned years ago. I don't remember when. It was a long time ago. It was just after I did my book on the Old Believers, Sobor Gnosti, very early book of mine, essays, translations, things like that. I've always been very sympathetic to the Old Believers. I'm not so sure I could actually live that life because it's very strictly communal. I do use their prayer rope, Listovka, which I greatly prefer over the Greek one. And I privately venerate their martyrs. They were not heretics in any way whatsoever. And specifically, I'm talking about those who maintained the hierarchy. But years ago, I came across a historical thesis, for the most part, either completely ignored. Even specialists in the Old Believers don't bring it up much. But I was surprised about the evidence behind it, and that is the existence and the role of the firstborn son of Tsar Alexis Mihailovich. So he would be Tsarevich Mikhail Alexeyevich. There's no mention of him officially ever existing, but there might be a good reason for that. And it also might go far in explaining why the Old Believers maintained their strength and power for a long time. Their huge size, tens of millions of people, maybe even understated, that despite their fractiousness, maintain their point of view in the countryside and in the cities to this very day. He would then be a part of the Miloslavsky clan. And there are sources that mention this son of Alexis that none of the historical establishment books or even non-establishment books ever mention. There are some sources that mention Mikhail, and he's significant because the theory is that he left Moscow very much on purpose as a young man, rejecting the way that the family was being run, rejecting the new right and the direction, especially people like Morozov and others, Westernizers who were just coming into prominence in Moscow, and created his own court out in the Trans-Volga region. Clearly, he was named after his grandfather, the founder of the Romanov dynasty. Indirect references to him could be found in the works of the bookkeeper of the Moscow printing house, Sylvester, or Simeon Medvedev, who was executed under Peter in 1691, the well-known writer Pavel Melnikov, Andre Petersky, as he's also known. He is the author of the novel In the Forest. He was an official in the Ministry of Internal Affairs of the Russian Empire. A historical novel from Daniel Mordovtsev called The Great Schism. And in that novel, which was meant to record actual events, although in literary form, in mentioning him, he relied on documents that were provided to him by the famous Russian historian Sergei Solovyov. The modern author, Vasily Komlev, in his book on this topic, The Secret Sovereign and the Great Schism, and there are other documents the Old Believers today have preserved, the correspondence of the Tsarevich Mikhail with Archpriest Avakum. He gave it to him before his self-immolation, and yes, that's how he died. I was reacquainted with this due to the article from Boris Yakmenev, and he has revitalized this issue, even in a non-Old Believer audience. So now you have a phantom son who was the core of the rural Old Believer movement after the destruction of the monastery of Solovki, which is a completely separate issue. It was a disgusting thing. And Tsar Alexei died shortly thereafter. They destroyed what I think was the largest monastery in Russia because they refused to go along with the old rite, the new rite. I'm assuming that most of my listeners know what an Old Believer is. There was a revolution going on in Russian society after the time of trouble. Second Tsar, after that, Second Romanov, Alexis, that was to create tremendous trouble. And it created a schism, not just religiously, but as Dugin would say, Solzhenitsyn would say, so many others, within the Russian mind itself. Russia as a nation versus Russia as an empire. The revolution, of course, we can call vaguely Westernization. And it was Alexis who first brought in people who were promoting the monetization and bureaucratization of Russia to take her from a nation and make her into an empire. Now, officially, Tsar Alexis had six sons: Dmitry, Alexei, named for his father, Fyodor, Simeon, John, and Peter. Strangely, though, and I never thought of this before, he doesn't have a son named Mikhail? That really doesn't make sense. Alexei's father is Mikhail, the founder of the dynasty of Romanov. And he's not going to name a son after? You would think that his firstborn, without doubt, would be named Mikhail. That right away is interesting. Because the House of Romanov was new, it was very important that Alexis get married and produce an heir. They could not afford a new dynastic crisis. The name Razov is going to come up a lot, Boris, a westernizer, probably the very first westernizer, led his advisory council and encouraged the monarch to marry soon and start having children. Now, this was actually a love match. The wedding was January 1648, and allegedly the first son was Dmitry, born in October of that same year. There's a few things you have to keep in mind. The world post-Alexis and the world under Peter the Great did all they could to eliminate the documents referring to the Miloslavsky family, official Boyar family histories, and a lot of information on Russia prior to this revolutionary era. Remember, the new rite was promulgated against the Stoglav, or the Hundred Chapters Synod under Ivan the Terrible, which was the core synod of Russian Orthodox idea. So the fact that Alexis was married twice meant that you now had two families. I think many of you know, Miloslavskis and the Naryshkins. The latter actually won and was able to put Peter the Great on the throne. And their war against each other got very bitter. In March 1669, Mikhail, that is to say, the phantom son of Alexis, his mother died, and that's why his father had to marry the very ambitious Natalia Nadezhkina, who was the ward of the head of the ambassador's office. A very difficult, and another westernizer, another difficult person, Artemon Matveyev. He is in the running for this forcible westernization. In fact, he was married to a Scottish woman, Mary Hamilton. And not only did he raise Natalia in a European manner, but his entire household in a European manner. Later on, he was suspected of poisoning Tsar Alexei. And it's hard to say whether his, you know, they accused him of various forms of black magic, which were introduced, you know, alchemy and the arcana, introduced into Russia via the Judaizers, via Novgorod years earlier. But the sons of the Miloslavsky family seemed to die very quickly. The Narishkin-Romanov alliance then were permitted the opportunity to determine the course of Russian history. There is an old document from 1672. It's a conversation between Patriarch Pitalim and Alexei Mihailovich. And let me quote it here. "Your son, Tsarevich Mikhail, sympathizing with those sisters, often, they say, visit them to look through the bars of their martyrdom and listens to them with emotion." Okay, he mentions your son, Tsarevich Mikhail. The sisters he makes reference to are the Princess Evdokia and the Boravna Morozova, friends of the Tsar's first wife, who all backed the Old Believers. After the first wife, the Miloslavska, died, that whole family fell into disgrace, and Matveyev was able to take over. It was a revolutionary time because these people, Matveyev, Morozov, were trying to bureaucratize the country, make it more Western, and turn it into an empire. That means everything had to be changed. The right was at least in part about creating this universal service that could encompass, you know, Ukraine, Belarus, even the Balkans, if that's where this was going to go. There was a lot of palace intrigue between the Miloslavskis and the Narishkins, but because the Tsarevich Mikhail, sympathetic to the Old Believers, opponents of the new right, he left the capital without his father's permission, roughly in 1673. His younger brother, Alexei, died unexpectedly, shortly after the death of his mother. Very suspicious circumstance. This was also a time of uprising. The Salt Riots, 1648 and later on, were based on high taxation, but tremendous corruption. Boris Morozov, the man who began the bureaucratization of the state, became extremely unpopular. The tradition, and really the tradition was that there was a personal relationship with the monarch. The monarch always was popular. People like Morozov, you know, these pseudo-sophisticates, did lead him astray. It's not a myth. It's simply how it was. And the rioters and the leadership said, people like Morozov, they're trying to turn you against us and vice versa. They saw Morozov as a usurper, altering the nature of the established system. And of course, behind all of this was a rivalry between those two families. Of course, the Narishkins eventually won when Peter became Tsar, as they said. But there have been cases in Russian history where the second wives of rulers exterminated the children of their predecessors. Ivan III's son from his first marriage, an heir to the throne, Prince Ivan, died unexpectedly, the age of 32 in 1490. and his young son Dmitri, although he was crowned by his grandfather in 1498, fell into disgrace in 1502 as a result of the intrigue of the Tsar's new wife, Sophia. He died in prison in 1509. So the concept that the Tsarevich Mikhail needed to escape Moscow and reject all of this, there's certainly an impetus there, and there's precedent there. Of course, Alexei Mikhailovich, the Tsar, was very angry, and that was fueled by his young wife and Aron Matveyev. And he was deprived of his rights to the throne. There were attempts afterwards to erase him from history, from the Naryshkins. On September 1st, 1674, the Tsar declared 13-year-old Fyodor as his heir on Red Square. It was an oddity, but as far as the old rite is concerned, one of the arguments against it, when the creation of the new rite and its violent imposition on the population, are the people who first promoted it. Greeks in Moscow didn't have a great reputation. They were engaged in all sorts of fraud, you know, selling glass beads, passing them off as precious stones, this kind of thing. You had hierarchs, or people claiming to be hierarchs, from, you know, the Middle East, all these exotic lands. They were selling divorce permits, even spiritual titles. And there's plenty of documentation at the time, contemporary documentation, laying this out. The Greeks were respected, but there was a reason that the empire fell. Translations of, in Russia anyway, the sacred books were made both from Greek and Bulgarian sources. Of course, Bulgarian also originated with the Greek many years earlier, centuries earlier. Trying to work with the Greek originals, a leader of this correction movement, the correction was not a problem, Fyodor Rychtchev, invited a Archimandrite Benedict, who called himself a doctor of theology from Constantinople, brought him into Moscow, but he was another swindler. He forged all of his, you know, papers identifying himself. There were a lot of questionable characters. The Syrian Metropolitan of Gaza, actually. Paisios. Arshin, the Greek, who at least was Jewish at one point in his life. Arshin was a man he was an adventurer. He went from place to place and switched from faith to faith. He was a Jew, then he was a Catholic in Italy, he was a Muslim in Turkey, a Uniate in Poland. And eventually, once this was found out, he was exiled to Solovki. These were the people, though, who for a while were trusted to not just import the holy books into Russia with the new translations, but to impose them. It wasn't just the old Rite that was condemned. It was Russia as the Third Rome that was condemned. So it's a lot more than two fingers and all the, you know, cliche things. Nikon shook the foundation. The Patriarch Nikon, who ruled alongside Alexis. Alexis saw him as a father figure. He brought what amounted to Uniate books in Greek from Venice. The Slavic translation of the Bible, especially the St. Gennadius Bible in Slavonic, and the liturgical spiritual literature compiled by these great ascetics. Now, this is being done by people like Arson, Paisios, and others. Frauds, tobacco traders, sodomites. Nikon went so far as to call himself, in a matter of speaking, an Orthodox Pope, superior to the state, which went a little far. Sir Alexis supported Nikon for a long time, but he eventually lost patience and condemned him. But by this point, it was too late. The year in our reckoning was 1666. An infamous synod was there to replace, well, put together to replace Nikon. Some of these adventurers were present there. Nikon was deposed, but in the process, they confirmed his previous anathemas against the old faith, the old rite, and, as I mentioned before, canceled the core synod, the 100 chapters. They had no authority to do this. They had no reason to do this. It was simply done. They anathematized the doctrine of Holy Russia and the Third Rome. So it wasn't just a matter of liturgy, but it was also a matter of spirit. And it wasn't done by Russians. For the most part, these dubious legates of these Greek and Jerusalem patriarchs, or patriarchates, or metropolitanates, such as they were, took a long time for it to finally come back that these weren't who they say they were. They were deposed beforehand. And the very fact that Russians saw the Greeks partially as an exotic, very brilliant people, but partially as an untrustworthy group whose empire fell because they insisted on going to the West, going to Venice and Rome for military assistance, which of course never showed up. Deacon Fyodor Ivanov, in a letter to Tsar Alexis, and I saw this in the works of Kartashev, A.V. Kartashev. Let me quote him here. "The current books that Petrarch Nikon sent to Greece to buy, from which they now translate, they're called Greek, and there they print those books under the authority of the apostate Pope of Rome in three cities, in Rome, Paris, and Venice, in the Greek language, but not according to the ancient Greek piety. For this reason, here too, the current translations, they don't agree even with each other, the sovereign, and now there is great unrest." It's difficult for us to put ourselves in the mind of the average Russian, especially the average literate Russian Orthodox man. Tens of thousands of churches. You had millions of parishioners hearing these words, these prayers, for centuries, every single day, memorized since childhood, and now they've been changed. They've been shortened. It was hard for the psyche to adapt to these. It was disturbing to remove words, to skip prayers. Nikon looked back on his work as destructive. He even began to question the legitimacy of those who came after him. But at that point, the Tsar only had two living sons, the 11-year-old Fyodor and the 6-year-old Ivan. There's another one, conversation between Patriarch Petrium and Tsar Alexis. Also, I mentioned that already. I have two different translations of it, pretty much saying the same thing, that the women on the Miloslavsky side were vehemently opposed to these. Morozova, who, you have that famous picture of her in the sleigh. There's been a few copies of this document made where it mentions Zarevitz Mikhail. So no one's quite sure who he's referring to here. Yet people like Wordovtsev, who wrote the book The Great Schism, was very careful about documents. In fact, Soloviev even cites in his famous multi-volume history of Russia, because the phantom Tsar Mikhail was a Miloslavsky, of course, he's firstborn. When they were disgraced, when Tsar Alexis married the second time, the Naryshkins now had every reason in the world to repress the very existence of the Tsarevich Mikhail. Alexei really wasn't concerned a lot with what was going on around him with his new wife. Yes, he did escape. He did leave. He received a plan of escape because he was an unbending opponent of church reform, and he was in very close contact with the new old believer martyr, Avakum. Avakum would write in very harsh words to Tsar Alexis, "Your son after you will disperse all those who suffer in Christ and are faithful according to the old books of our Lord Jesus Christ." Your son after you. Well, what son is he talking about? There was no evidence that these kids, I mean actual kids, Fyodor and Ivan, had any interest in this stuff. So he can only be referring to really his spiritual son, the Tsarevich Mikhail. Slavikum confronted the Tsar. He confronted anybody. But the notion that your son will come after you and disperse the new right and elevate those who are faithful according to the old books. Tsarevich Mikhail was moving towards Soloveitsky and the White Sea. Of course, early on, the main stronghold of the old right, the rejection of Patriarch Nikon's innovations and then the synod that followed. These were, at this point, fugitives. They went to they went by Nizhny Novgorod, past the Makariyev Monastery. We're in the region, I get vaguely the Transvolga region, and the old believer monastics and hermits created their skeets there. Ephraim Potemkin, Sergei Soltikov, and there, this is very close, by the way, to the old Kitej, Lake Svetlyar. The Nizhny Novgorod Chronicle, or chronicler, I should say. This is what he says about it. April 23rd, 1673. In Nizhny Novgorod, in that district, a huge black cloud appeared in the sky, which burst into heavy hail. In other places, tons of snow fell, which covered the ground for 4 days. At night, hidden from casual eyes, along the Volga riverbed, which was about to break up, a sled train with fugitives headed for the mouth of the Kirzhnets River. While this was a secret movement, these fugitives were coming from Moscow. Once they set up shop there, it's not the most hospitable area. You had plenty of supporters with money and power who were sending them food as necessary, and some of these letters survived. They were coded, for obvious reasons, because Tsarevich now had to be hidden. I mean, for Mikhail to reject his father and go off on his own, he saw a very similar situation with Peter the Great. Especially at this point in time, it was unprecedented for this to happen. There was no forgiveness here. And that's why, as I mentioned, in 1674, the Tsar made a big deal about announcing that it's Fyodor on Red Square, in a parade almost, shown to the entire Muscovite state. This is the eldest. This is, he went out of his way to convince everybody, and even telling people to go back home and tell everyone else, the Archangel Cathedral, even foreign envoys, this is my firstborn. And it's odd that he had to make that point because, you know, it's not like this was a secret world. He was covering for something. He even said, "You've seen the Tsarevich's bright eyes and his young age, so make sure you write about this to your states." And he said that to the diplomatic corps. A very weird announcement. It's odd that the Tsar needed to announce the eldest son by a separate decree. But everyone knew of his son, but he had to make the point that he is the eldest and he is the heir to the throne. It's possible that the Tsar believed that he was at Soloveitsky, and is part of the reason why Tsar Alexis spared no expense to destroy this place. It is one of the most shameful pages in Russian history. By the order of the Russian Tsar, an army, mostly foreign, invaded and sacked an Orthodox monastery. Because so many of these, many Russians refused to go along with it, partially because of what it was, and partially because Mikhail was there, or at least nearby. Took a long time for this finally to be dealt with, but the slaughter of monks by these foreigners under the command of the Tsar, ultimate command of the Tsar, was shameful. And this is how the new right was promulgated. This is because the Westernizers that I mentioned already were a major part of the inner circle of Tsar Alexis. The faith was slowly let me put it this way, the revolution of Peter was made possible because of how the new rite was imposed. Archpriest Avakum predicted very much of this. After the slaughter of the monks, Avakum said, "There's nothing to reason about. There's nothing for a good man to listen to. This is savagery. This is paganism of the worst kind." Now, there is a claim that Avakum wrote to a disciple, a Simeon from Novgorod, but that these were actually written for Tsarevich Mikhail. The slaughter of the Solovyetsk monks is one of the reasons that early on, Avakum and his supporters, and eventually the majority of the Russian peasantry, saw this as apocalyptic, talking about the thief whore dressed up riding the royal purple, pouring from the golden cup, Apocalypse 17, making the Tsar and Tsarina drunk. Calling every heresy, and it's true, every heresy is called a whore and a matter of adultery. The Greeks are wise, he says, the whore's children. And the patriarchs, they eat scalloped chickens from the same dish as a Turkish barbarian. But the sweet Russians are different. They willingly climb into the fire. However, we will never betray our piety. It was a traitor, actually, a monk, Fyotist, was able to lead them to the proper path, to get to an open door. The Archimandrite Nicanor, before he was murdered, and confronted, you know, just before his death, confronted the governor who was in charge of that region. I mean, these monks were hung alive on hooks under the ribs, many frozen deliberately in ice. There weren't a whole lot that were saved. Now, the year, what in the old reckoning, 7184, was actually January, a meat fair Sunday. The number of murdered was either somewhere between 300 and 500. Wasn't that long after. 1676, 47-year-old Tsar Alexei Mikhailovich died. He didn't name a successor. But of course, the young princess, Sophia, organized the oath of allegiance to the boyar, to her younger brother, Fyodor, because they wanted to avoid the Matveyev party to proclaim Peter to the throne. 15-year-old Fyodor became the Tsar of Russia. As I mentioned, Artamon Matveyev was appointed regent. This was not accepted by everyone. A lot of people were aware that the Tsarevich Mikhail was a fugitive and yet was the legitimate ruler. It was clearly the eldest son who if you know, all other things being equal, is in a position to take over. That Fyodor was not accepted. And now, you had some of the best in Moscow fleeing the city, the Kerzhensky Forest near Lake Svetlyar. They were met by the Solovetsky fugitives, those who escaped, and they built what came to be the Old Believer monastic tradition. The three elders in particular, Arseny, Safrani, and Onofiri. Noblewoman, Anafisa Kulicheva, who was in fact a relative of St. Philip the Metropolitan, founded the Olenevsky Skeet on the river there. And you had dissatisfied nobility, not just from Moscow, but from elsewhere, showing up to this middle of nowhere place. And so what developed was some kind of a court. Tens of thousands fled to the Trans-Volga region. Entire villages moved. And it's no accident that this is where Ketej, the holy invisible city, is supposed to be. And the census actually confirms this. in Nizhny Novgorod, the census at the time said it's roughly 10,000 residents. 1719, in Kazanets, the middle of absolute nowhere, there were almost 50,000 people. Mikhail, according to reports, did get married. In fact, it was the niece of the boyar Mozarova, Anastasia, who became his wife. Avakum sent his blessing on all of this. Some of the coded writings suggest that this is going to be in a secret location. But it's good to keep in mind that one of the letters among old believers, the most literate part of the Russian population, it doesn't really translate very well, but it comes to, it's good to keep the Tsar secret. It's a very, if you don't know the story, it's a very strange way to communicate or to, you know, to end a letter. But of course, it's in reference to Mikhail. Now, Mikhail, at this point, made the most serious, the most irreparable mistake of his entire life. It wasn't like he hated his younger brother, Fyodor. He saw Fyodor as actually talented, that there could be a very successful reign here. So Mikhail wrote him a letter, had it secretly delivered to him, in which he says that he has no desire to interfere. He doesn't want to overthrow him. And he wishes him all the blessings in the world. Now, Fyodor was very young. He should have burnt it the minute he got it, but he talked about it with his closest circle. You know, Matveyev, Ivan Yazykov, Alexei Ligachev, not realizing really that what his brother wrote to him was sort of the equivalent to an abdication. See, the problem with good people is that it's very difficult to understand that those who are controlled by their passions, those striving for power, it's hard to imagine how people will take advantage of any pretext, any clue, any situation that gives them the slightest chance of achieving their ambitions and doing whatever it takes. It was this letter to his brother that expressed to the entire world how terrified these revolutionaries around Fyodor were, because you have a living heir, Mikhail, very popular, living secretly, living, and people didn't really know him by sight. You know, he had gotten older. I mentioned that Medvedev was in exile. He was suspected of poisoning Tsar Alexei and then attempting a coup in favor of the Naryshkin family. And there are some people who think that the accusation of black magic was not entirely false. There were a few Jews that testified to this, that he had a black book reading, actually one of his dwarfs, you know, Peter had them, the entertainers, I guess we would call them, I can't think of the name, court comedians, jesters, were summoning spirits. And again, it's that stuff was certainly believed. There are laws against it. Maybe it's just slander, but maybe it isn't. Archpriest Avakum, of course, the proto-martyr of the old belief, the secret confessor of Mikhail, thanks to the efforts of Matveyev and people like that, engaged in the burning of their opponents, including not just Avakum, but Lazar, Fyodor, Epifania. Then, the young Tsarina from the Polish family died a week later. The newborn Tsarevich Ilya died shortly after that. Matveyev, people like this, claimed to be a progressive westernizer, but they cared only about complete state power. Now, I mentioned before that this was revolutionary. The war against the translation that I use is localism. The war was declared by him January 1682. Localism referred to the fact, and this is Peter ended this, was rather than a bureaucracy, you would have powerful noble families under royal control carrying out royal decrees. The point was to destroy that nobility so that one generation won't remember the generations that came before it. Remember, nowhere else was the concept of a nation and family so closely related as in Russia. All families had a history that was written, it was memorized, it was understood. Any significant family had this. Everyone's close, everyone's distant relatives. When two strangers would meet on the street, they would go through their relatives as far back as they can, and maybe somewhere there'll be some cross or relation. And then that would be the foundation of their relationship. That was the foundation of the nation. All of Russia then was a family headed by the sovereign. And even this was the case for common folk too. Powerful noble families kept their family roots in a book. I think the translation is discharge books. And this was how various jobs, the pecking order was laid out. The nature of these family histories and the most heroic ones would be promoted, and the older ones would be promoted amongst others. But it wasn't just Peter that burned these books. So when they talk about Peter and Fyodor destroying historical documents, this is what we're talking about. The point was to destroy the much older Russian aristocratic families, and hence destroy, or at least transform, the Russian nation. Now, you read an establishment history book, they'll say that Peter the Great said that localism promoted family honor more than ability. And yet, it remains that there was a strong meritocracy here, despite everything. Nikon himself was a peasant from Novgorod. Any beautiful girl who pleased the Tsar when he was single could become the Tsarina. You don't have to be a member of a powerful family. Matveyev himself came from a non-noble family. Localism is the noble family rather than a professional bureaucracy. In destroying this, you destroyed the continuity of major families and hence Russian history. Because the major families would then merge and become Russia. Without that, you had no sense of identity. That means any scam artist could come in, talk a good game, and get hired. Part of the decree on the fight against localism was to, and this was oral, not written, was the prohibition on mentioning the name of Mikhail Alexievich Romanov. Some of the writers I mentioned before say that this is not just a decree, but a spell. Matveyev may well have been a warlock. The abuse of magic and the occult, you see this in the old prayer books, that there was a belief in the practical results of this stuff. The Tsar's decree, 1682, when the Slavonic Greek Latin Academy in Moscow was founded, stated that if there are teachers in the academy who possess the knowledge of magical rites, then together with their students, they will be eliminated without mercy like sorcerers. But once Fyodor signed this and eliminated, declared war on localism, he now wasn't useful anymore. He died April 27, 1682, 2 months after he got married. He was married to Marfa Praskina, who's the goddaughter of Matveyev. First thing after the wedding was the return of Matveyev from exile. His estates were returned to him. The death of a 21-year-old man, healthy man, was so unexpected, there was no time to even consider a successor. Matveyev apparently had foreseen all of this. He cunningly cleared his way to power. The only problem he had was the opinion of the common people. The capturing of the Solovetsky Monastery and Alexis's death very shortly thereafter, that was very suspicious. It's possible that Alexei learned that his entourage had been deceiving him. Not just about, you know, the world around him, but the whereabouts of his son. Maybe if he knew about this, he would have been able to forgive him. But that was is out of the question, because that would be like death to the Naryshkin and Matveyev party. One of the results of this is the Streltsy, or the elite infantry or archers in the capital, rebelled against the system. One of the reasons they did was they knew what Artemon Matveyev, Danila the doctor, that they were, their head was demanded by the military because they did poison. And Danila the Jew, the doctor, confessed to all of this. Fyodor, there was this myth that Fyodor was, and Ivan, they were both dead, as I mentioned, very young. They weren't sick by birth. The elite in Russia was fond of poisons. The French were the same way. This was yet another palace coup. The uprising of the Moscow archers, the elite infantry, 1682, under Prince Klovansky, demanded the restoration of the old right. Peter's half-sister Sophia was in a semi-regent position, but they had turned against her. Klovansky demanded the reversal of Nikon's reforms and a return to the old books, both in terms of the family rule as well as liturgy. Sophia had to flee the Kremlin and went to the Troitsis Sergius Monastery. She eventually was able to suppress this. And they were really essentially bought off. It's pretty clear that Klovansky sided with the sovereign Mikhail. He was executed before he could say much about it. The claim was that he organized a conspiracy with the old believers for his own personal power, but he was in no position to take over. He simply couldn't. As time goes on, violence, various uprisings, both church and state were very upset about the fact that Mikhail still lived. The fact that he didn't want power, that's one thing. It didn't matter. He existed. They took any sense of spirituality for stupidity. Mikhail did believe that the apocalypse was coming upon Russia. He also knew that the wolves who were controlling Moscow were tearing each other apart. Any mention of Mikhail was violently eliminated. And this is why the persecution of his supporters, the old believers, were repeatedly intensified. Peter himself took power in a coup. He purged the church in every way. You had elites, especially the older Russian families, beheaded all over the place. There was a deafening silence. Until 1707, Peter the Great endured this very independent, brother. But he was also aware that people in that area who had fled Russia in the big cities to his region in Katej, Lake Svetlar, did not accept him. And of course, no old believer accepted him. Metropolitan Isaiah of Novgorod, very loyal to the old believer, very hostile to Peter, of course, was removed. Metropolitan Sylvester appointed in his place. this is part of the reason that the old right Cossacks under Kondraty Bulavin started an uprising. This lasted until 1710. There were searches after this for Mikhail. Now, none of those living there, Kirzhenets, maybe there were a handful of the elder spiritual fathers, knew him by sight. He was living a life of with his family as a commoner. He did not appear to be wealthy or anything else. But because the search parties for him increased, an elder, Sofroni, convinced him to commit suicide. Self-immolation, which is a very bizarre, the most extreme of the old believers did this. I'm not even sure what purpose it served. You can imagine the torment and the torture of that someone would need to do this. There were others who tried to dissuade him from this. Everyone knew Peter the Great's temper, but he wasn't going to leave Tsar Mikhail and his family alive. Even if he surrendered, well, what happened with Peter's own son, Alexei, was tortured to death in 1718. He had previously escaped, just like Mikhail did. Mikhail and his sons did commit suicide. Avakum wrote to Mikhail in a letter saying, and I always struggle with these translations of the much older style of writing. Avakum says, "And in that fire here, you might have to endure for a little while at the blinking of an eye, and the soul will come out. That's reasonable. Are you afraid of the furnace? Go ahead, spit on it. The furnace is terrifying, but when you enter it, you forget everything." It seems that he's making a distinction. You burn now, so you don't burn later. And this fragment of Abakum's letter is actually quoted in Milinkov-Pachersky's novel In the Forest. And in fact, he even discovered the site of Mikhail's self-immolation in his own work near the Skeets in the Polomsky Forest, not far from Lake Svetliar, on February 4th, the old style, 1708. In the novel by Milinkov-Pachersky, that there was a site, he discovered the site of the self-immolation, that there were crosses that were laid there for a very long time, and local residents took them as absolutely, including even the ashes that were there, the soil that was there, was considered holy. Peter the First, Peter the Great, was aware of his half-brother's existence. He certainly had the right to claim the throne, but of course had no intention of doing it. It's possible that Mikhail's sister, Marfa, who died that same year, held him back. But once she was gone, that's when Peter went on the warpath to destroy the Miloslavsky clan. And of course, Mikhail would have been a part of that. I mentioned the search parties looking for him. They used old believers who they could buy off. They knew that they were closing in. He knew and his family knew that they were closing in on him. So it isn't like this is a obscure theory, but you have some big names who accepted it. Now, there's other points of view here that his wife, Anastasia, and his three young sons did survive, did not, but traveled south to Turkey. There's a few people who hold to that point of view. So many of the old believers went into the Ottoman lands. But there's a lot of reason to believe that the strength of the old rite came from not just the liturgy itself, but the fact that there was an alternative ruler to build the alternative city of Kitej. There is no doubt that not long after Mikhail escaped Moscow, thousands of people, including some very wealthy ones, flocked to that area. The foundation of a chapel was laid by Metropolitan Nikolai of Novgorod. Supposed to open in 2000, consecrated in 2001, actually. The Old Believers. Pavel Milinkov, as I mentioned in his notes that come from Letters on the Schism, which is another book from him, he says, the schism and schismatics represent one of the most curious phenomena in the historical life of the Russian people. But this phenomenon, though it has existed for more than two centuries, remains poorly unexplored. Neither the administration nor society know in detail what the schism is. This is not enough. 9/10 of the schismatics themselves do not fully understand what the schism is. Milinkov wrote a 3-volume history of this. It was not permitted to be published. Milinkov, minister of the, what we would call Ministry of the Interior, found and was able to trace the life of Mikhail Alexeyevich. And he was part of the reason why there were 10 million schismatics, not to mention hundreds of thousands all over the world. Pavel Milinkov initially was a zealous persecutor of the Old Believers, but near the end of his life, he changed internal affairs. He changed his opinion. He wrote in 1866, "The schismatic environment, despite its religious delusions, has many good signs. Educated Old Believers will bring new elements into our lives, or better to say, old ones, forgotten by us from the influx of Western concepts and customs not akin to either the Russian land or the Russian soul, elements undermined by Peter the Great." There were some that were well aware of the work of Milinkov. He was too well known. I mean, you had literature written on this as a continuation of the theme of Kitej. There was a close connection between Tsar Mikhail and the utopian city of Kitej. There are some reasons. And I can't 100% say that he actually existed. I tend to think he did, especially after the destruction of Soloveitsky and the war made on localism, which would include the Miloslavskis, and Peter's burning of these books and these historical documents. It's very easy for him to be reduced to almost a handful of mentions, as I've mentioned. The population influx in this area, the Transvolgan area where Neil Sorsky used to be, that has not been explained. It's not just religious, but it's also dynastic. That Mikhail was a symbol for Russian nationalism. But the mentality came from the ruins of Soloveitsky. There's too many people who have made reference to Mikhail either directly or indirectly. And with the persecution of the Old Believers, so much has gone up in flames. When you're dealing with power-obsessed people like Matveyev, to have a potential alternative power source leave Moscow and then be stamped out of historical existence, that certainly is anything but unbelievable. And this is part of the reason why the Old Believers never recognized Peter as a legitimate sovereign, that there was someone else. So many Old Believer documents refer to this other sovereign that exists. Moscow had rejected Peter, which is why he ruthlessly built St. Petersburg. There's a reason for this, and it may well be that there was another czar, a legitimate czar, a czar Mikhail, who ritually killed himself rather than be tortured to death by his enemies. Thank you, everyone, for listening. I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.